always been something used against websites. It's regularly, and I mean regularly, attempted against probably every website out there. I know that every time I look at a website that actually has a web application firewall, also known as a WAF, a web application firewall, what I'm seeing is on a daily basis, there are a lot of SQL injection attacks. In some cases, they are even on a microscope. You would look at a website and say, oh, that's just a tiny website. Nobody cares about that website. Well, you look at the WAF and you'd be surprised how many times you're seeing SQL injection attacks against that website on a daily basis. So that means that the bad guys are just trying SQL injection attacks on basically all websites all the time, right? So you can't presume that they don't care about your website. They're going to use your website and hack it just for fun sometimes. In some cases, they'll try it to see if they can put something malicious on there that then you will access as the administrator of that website and download it and then infect your machine. And then, well, the fun proceeds from there, right? So SQL injection is something that we've known about for more than 20 years. The OWASP, which is the Open Web Application, I believe it's like security practices, but anyways, it's the OWASP standards do a phenomenal job of describing how to mitigate the risk of SQL injection. And ultimately, what SQL injection protection does is it validates form entry. This means that any sort of an entry form that somebody can put content into on your website, that input would be validated against whether that input is valid for that field or not. And if it's not, then it's going to be deemed a SQL injection attack and blocked. Now, a lot of the things that why a SQL injection attack is done is to gain back-end database access for, data exfiltration, data theft, or further ability to compromise a website. And I really can't stress the importance of this stuff enough because so many organizations have been breached because their internet-facing website was first breached. And then the bad guys were able to laterally move from inside that system to other corporate systems. And you really have to wonder, why isn't that company just hosting their website someplace that's completely isolated? I mean, why would they even have it under any realm of connectivity connected to their corporate network in any way? Boggles my mind. I would never go down that route. I don't agree with if you're a company and you've got a website, why would you ever host that in any shape, size, or flavor connected to your corporate network in any way? I mean, if you just have it in a completely isolated space, then you're preventing this whole lateral movement attack outside of, breached credentials or something like that. So the SQL injection attack was that the Verizon team got brought in on was about an HR portal. And the executives of this company had actually had their payroll stolen for 2 pay periods in a row. And what happened was that the bad guys would SQL inject it. They SQL inject attacked the horrifically programmed HR portal, and then they'd go in there and they'd manipulate the bank wire or direct deposit data. And then after the direct deposit data or the direct deposit was done, then they'd go back in there into this HR management system and put it back to what it was. So when somebody from HR would look at it and go, well, is that the right data or not? They'd look at it and they say, well, yeah, that's the right data, except they had no audit trail or anything, so they couldn't tell what was actually happening. They couldn't know that somebody had logged into that website from an external IP address and had changed that data. So let's talk about why this website got breached and how it could have been prevented. So first of all, we've already talked about this with SQL injection, so we know that the Website forms themselves did not adequately validate the data that was input into form fields. Secondly of all, this was an HR management application, and yet some insane individual made this a public-facing website. I mean, seriously, can you make an argument that external parties should even have the ability to see that that website even exists? No. So then what crazy person decided to make it internet accessible? And the interesting thing is that this thing had been in place for 10 years. It had never been patched. There was no web application firewall on it. And that it was ever invented to begin with like this was just horrifically bad programming. And that anybody ever put it on the internet-facing side to begin with was crazy. But what's really shocking is that this app existed, this website existed inside this company for a decade. And during that time period, not a single IT person questioned the craziness of this thing. And the login, the credential mechanism for this was social security number and a 6-digit PIN. And the 6-digit PIN could easily be brute force attacked. So there was no like account lockout on it. It didn't have Windows integrated authentication or anything like that. I mean, the whole thing was just so catastrophically messed up. It was just horrific. So, you know, I mean, you have to learn from these egregious mistakes that people make, because when something is that egregious and you see it in your environment, you should have like sirens going off in your head and saying, I need to talk to the appropriate people to tell them how egregiously out of standard or out of compliance and unacceptable this particular thing is, because it's such a huge risk profile, such an obvious risk profile to the organization. We must do something about it. Okay. So I'll move on to the next one, which is CMS compromise. This is on the same whole topic of websites, because CMS is what is called a content management system. And content management systems are pretty ubiquitous nowadays. I mean, literally any website that you look at is a content management system. If you're talking, you know, we're talking about WordPress and Joomla, Blogger, and then, you know, things like Titan, which is more proprietary, SharePoint, literally any sort of website that is based upon a content management system is deemed content management system. And I don't know of anybody that's managing websites without a CMS anymore, because it's just too painful to do so without a CMS. So if you do have a website, then you need to be patching it, right? You need to make sure that your content management system is patched. You need a web application firewall on it. You need to make sure that all the extensions that are used are getting patched. Because otherwise, this content management system is exposed to the internet. And, oh, I'll also say that your web application firewall on the CMS should be using a GeoIP blocker as well. Because unless you're doing business with Botswana, I don't think you need to have traffic from Botswana hitting your website. So the CMS, the reason that it is such a big target is the thing I said before about they're trying to hack your website so that they can then potentially hack you. But what if your website includes other business data? And in the case that Verizon found, a homegrown content management system was put up by a shipping company, and it was used to manage shipping inventories and bills of lading on all of their international shipping vessels. So it really ended up creating a massive problem where they lost, they lost quite a lot of business, because pirates took their cargo containers. You know, and all of this was because their CMS wasn't patched. So When you sit there and look at things and say, oh, well, I don't want to pay somebody, I don't want to pay to have a professional look at that. I don't need security. It's not that important. Well, compared to what? All right. So, the Verizon Data Breach Report does a really great job of walking you through the common CMS attack chain of events. And if you're really interested in that, I would suggest that you read that because it's quite good. The next scenario they talk about is backdoor access. And I don't know if they selected some of these stories because they were just so obviously egregious. You just wanted to fish slap somebody and say, how could you ever be that ignorant that you wouldn't have these pieces in place? And I mean, I realize I live a little bit of a sheltered existence living as a security architect, being mostly only working with people who actually care about security, but I still find it shocking that so many supposed IT professionals allow egregious misconfigurations to exist, especially when we've known for more than 20 years. When I say we, I'm talking about the general IT community. I mean, you can't pick up an IT management textbook in any school where it doesn't tell you about IT security standards and best practices. And some of these things are just so completely obvious that they, and the fact that they continue to be violated rather than being ubiquitously implemented successfully is shocking. It's not like, trying to defeat ransomware. Okay, ransomware is relatively new. Maybe we've seen it for the last 3 to 4 years. It's not something that we've had ubiquitous knowledge of for the last 20 years, right? So, like for example, when I see people that don't have adequate backups, really, you wonder about that and you wonder what are they thinking? Why do you not have backups? Like, how silly is that? So, I mean, I understand that if it's your intent to have backups, but you're having some issues, okay, fine. I'm not going to be critical about that because we all have technical challenges that we have to deal with. But when people have just decided, yeah, I don't need any backups, and then, poo hits the fan, and then they find that, oh, I guess I needed those backups. I can't have any sympathy for that because the necessity of having backups is not a new concept. I mean, everybody knows this. People in their 70s and 80s know this. Okay. So with regards to this one where they call backdoor access, it was in a company that had an R&D in department, and the network team found a ton of connections between IP connections between the R&D department and a particular external IP address. And that during the previous 24 hours, there had been an outbound transfer of over 2 gigabytes of data. Now, I found it rather interesting that they even were able to detect this. So that's nice that they could do that. And it makes me think of the fact that this is why everyone needs SIM logging that actually summarizes in an executive summary report on a daily or weekly basis what is going on at the network level so that the network team can spot anomalies. For example, they should know. Oh, well, these are internal IP addresses from the R&D department, and I don't think they should have been transmitting 2 gigabytes of data to this single external IP address. So, yeah, you have to have SIM logging. If you're not doing long-term logging of your network traffic data, this is really problematic. Because otherwise, how can you possibly have any sort of an idea about anomalies? So, it turns out that user credentials for everyone that had logged on to a particular shared system, those credentials were compromised. And this is why shared workstations don't work real good as a concept. But remember what I said, that credential theft techniques are oftentimes mitigated by changing the password. So, obviously, they're also mitigated by using multi-factor authentication. So, the Mimikatz hack, as well as the pass the hash hacks, those things are completely mitigated by simply changing the password, because those cached credentials become invalidated when the password is changed. So it might make sense to have everybody in the R&D department change their password every 14 days. I know there's some accounting firms that actually have that policy. And then the Verizon team looked through what else was happening with these the foreign IP address where this data was going to, and they looked at the malware and how this particular malware that was doing these attacks against this R&D department was associated with a previously identified advanced persistent threat. Okay, well, now this brings up a bunch of interesting questions. Number one, was APT scanning enabled at the endpoint security product on that machine? Number two, was APT scanning and blocking enabled at the network layer? If not, why? Why wasn't it? And three, did the email system have malicious URL scanning and quarantine capabilities? Now, I ask that because the original infection came in through a spear phishing email that really should not have ever even gotten through, because if this company had proper email scanning capabilities, the email scanning system would have seen that that was a malicious URL and blocked it. So this is what we call the cybersecurity kill chain, and had any one of these things been in place properly as a mitigation, it actually could have stopped the entire breach. Certainly stopped it from going further. So there's other aspects to this, though, which is end user training. And we see this a lot in sensitive departments such as finance and research and development. So if you have R&D people, they need to have different credentials for secure systems than they do for their insecure systems. They need to have different systems in general for the secure and kind of more risky functionality. And never the twain shall meet. I mean, you shouldn't even be able to look at email on the secure systems. And so in that circumstance, if the phishing email was sent, then it would have been sent only to one of the insecure systems. And if credential theft had happened there, well, that system would have been isolated from the R&D systems. You know, and anyone who says to me, oh, well, that's just too difficult for the end users to make work, I would challenge you to determine the cost profile of a breach. So how does it make sense to spend years and years of salary and productivity time, time that you'll never get back, competitive time, developing stuff, and then doing insufficient things that could lead to a breach or loss of this R&D data that you have for your business, and have that lost in a very short period of time? Then you're effectively lighting on fire not only that time that you're never going to get back, but all of the lost productivity of that those employees in R&D, and then of course all the actual real costs of their salary. So I'm pretty certain that somebody could be creative and could come up with a way to have the engineers be able to do their jobs and do them securely and in a secure way that enabled them to still be efficient. You know, it's just, and I can tell you, I remember in 1997, Modine Manufacturing Company was using an isolated approach just like that, and they were doing it very effectively, and I'm sure they're still doing those effective techniques to this day, and it's because it makes sense. And so if it made sense to them 20 years ago, it should make sense to people today to do those sorts of isolated techniques. And really, it's just not that expensive to set up a network layer segmentation and the OS layer segmentation and train your people to do things in a secure way. It's just not that hard. And at least then in that case, you get to control the cost profile. This particular breach also brings up again this whole topic of GOIP blocking. So I'm going to briefly go through Verizon's particular remediation recommendations for this particular breach, because a lot of very interesting things to learn from it. They say implement network level blocks of foreign IP addresses. Okay, that's really GOIP blocking. They say block all internet access for the in-scope network segment. So when they say in-scope, they're talking about the R&D department. and say, well, do you really need to get to the internet for the R&D segment, the R&D computers? Probably not. Then force change passwords for all employees. That means have a password policy, have it be a strong and secure password policy, and preferably have it be a multi-factor authentication password policy. The next one is prohibit further access to external or cloud-based collaboration sites. So that's really, it could be as simple as, do you really want your R&D department to have access from their R&D systems to Dropbox so that they or others, malicious actors, could use Dropbox as a depository for your corporate intellectual property? No, probably you don't want that. Well, so think that through. And this is all about having proper web content filtering policies in place. By the way, that approach is identical to something for like an insurance firm or a healthcare facility or really any organization that has secure data. You can't, don't get complacent thinking that your data loss prevention policies actually work really well. It's almost never that DLP systems are comprehensively effective. So I'm not against DLP, but they are an astronomically difficult thing to set up, and they are not ubiquitous. So, we're talking about your DLP policies in email are separate from your DLP policies in SharePoint or OneDrive, and then there's the DLP policies on your endpoint protection, and the DLP policies for your web content filtering, and then there's DLP for FTP. I mean, you could go on and on and on and on and on. And so who maintains this? I mean, I swear for a typical company, DLP management could be one person's full-time job for all of the disparate systems. And it's so easy to have false positives with DLP that it's just, I mean, it's really a beast to try and fine-tune it. So because of that, I don't find that DLP is really an effective mitigation technique in the majority of cases, because it's so easy to have a misconfiguration because it's just so difficult to configure properly. So Verizon goes on to, of course, talk about multi-factor authentication and prohibiting employee access to personal email and other non-work related websites. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Please. Do people really need to be doing Facebook on work hours? Do people really need to have access to all this stuff? And I mean, to me, this goes beyond employee productivity. Okay, even if you have a tremendously wonderful workforce and you've got some sort of like open format office where, people can see what other people are doing and you think that that's an adequate checks and balances system, that in itself doesn't actually address the security concerns. I would much rather take the approach, if it was my business, I would rather much take the, rather much more so take the approach of saying, look, do you need access to that resource in order to do your job? If you do, fine, then I'm going to find a way for you to be able to have secure access to that resource so you can do your job. But if you don't need that, well, then it doesn't need to be a risk profile for the business. Because, I mean, I just don't think employees are going to get so disgruntled that they're going to quit their job because you don't give them access to Pandora. There's so many other ways to have music. Or if you don't use Dropbox in your business, then don't allow access to it because Dropbox has no security. Unless you've paid for Dropbox for Business and you've put a third-party security plugin into your Dropbox for Business corporate account, it's not going to have any security scanning built into it. All right, the next one is DNS tunneling, and I loved that they brought this up because Verizon actually has two different scenarios that are talking about DNS tunneling, DNS exfiltration. And I love that they brought this up because I did a whole DNS data exfiltration special podcast previously and literally told you how to implement DNS data exfiltration and how to mitigate these risks. So, I love that Verizon went through this because there's so many people that don't see DNS as a data exfiltration problem. They aren't doing DNSSEC. They are not logging DNS. They're not defining scopes of what endpoints should and should not be able to talk to, and using DNS proxies. So there's the two scenarios that Verizon talks about, what they're basically talking about is how these companies that got breached and lost data over the DNS channel could have put in those very easy to implement DNS security controls, and it would have prevented the entire problem that they had. It's just not hard, people. The point at which you can't get the job done is when you have not consulted with somebody who knows how to get this done. And what I mean by that is, we see this oftentimes in the perimeter security appliance landscape where let's say you call up the manufacturer and you're talking to an inside sales engineer. Well, that inside sales engineer is not a field security architect. Okay, now, I'm somebody who supports over 100 perimeter security appliances, so I see what happens in 100 plus different environments. And this is on a day-to-day basis in the field. How are things reacting? What works? What doesn't work? That is not the type of experience that the manufacturer's internal sales is going to have. They just don't have access to that information. And nothing against them, it's just that's not part of the scope of what they have access to in terms of data set. And they're not security architects, so they're going to tell you to buy a particular security appliance based upon a set of criteria that is incomplete. And the reality is that you will get too small of an appliance. So security appliances are all about RAM and processor, and if you don't have enough RAM and processor, what you're going to find is you end up not being able to do things like DNS proxy. And DNS proxy is incredibly important. It's incredibly valuable. You need to be doing DNS logging on the internal DNS servers and then have proper network segmentation and ACLs. And that is way more complicated than what is in the scope of the discussion right here. If you want more detail on that, I do strongly suggest that you check out my podcast on that very same topic. Okay, then Verizon moved on to the topic of malicious software, and they talk about data getting exported using unsanctioned encryption, and that there was inadequate egress filtering and monitoring. So this is this whole thing of if you're not doing deep packet inspection, then you can't see what's going on. They're saying they see a lot of keystroke loggers. If you implement multi-factor authentication, you're mitigating the risk of that. Backdoor Trojans. If you use proxies for internet-based traffic and implement deep packet inspection, you can mitigate the risk of backdoors. And then there's RAM scrapers for POS systems, and so much of that is about having quality POS systems and making sure that they're maintained effectively. Then another malicious software vector that they talk about is C2 platforms, and what they're really talking about is command and control, remote access Trojan, really horrifically nasty things, which are almost always packaged with keystroke loggers and screen capture devices. So those can be mitigated by using threat intelligence to prevent connections to known botnet and command and control servers. So that's it for today's show. I hope you've enjoyed it and learned quite a lot out of it. And I think you'll also find that there is a tremendous amount of similarity between everything that we're learning from this report and the things that I've taught you before on previous Breakfast Bites podcast.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
Support comes from Piasecki Althaus, providing unmatched compassionate service since 1931, dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha. Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program. And Steve